just very briefly introduce the images. These are supplementary to the exhibition. The first half of this, these will just scroll through. The first half were all taken in Palestine over the last sort of 10 years or so. The second half, in the middle of the presentation, there's a couple of black and white images, a portrait from Palestine, and then an image from Kenya, and then the rest of the images are from Kenya, mostly from archives, but also some that I've taken. And I can talk more about those later. Okay. It's a given that all settler colonial projects reassemble the geographies being dispossessed for settlement, engender zones of separation, assemble sites of control, surveillance, interrogation, and detention, and rewrite the narratives of ownership and of historical genealogy. The late Patrick Wolfe delineated settler colonialism as a structure, not as an event. His logic is the elimination of the native of indigenous populations. This elimination, together with the construction of terra nullius, the occupation of an already inhabited land, and in the case of Palestine, a land already under imperial and colonial occupation, requires the colonized to relinquish attachment to land, to known histories and systems of knowledge, and if not voluntarily, then by force. Elimination, or in my categorization, erasure of the indigenous population already holds within it a set of colonial logic of punishment, of incarceration, of racialized violence, as it engenders the structures, laws, and practices of cleaning the land, of in fact constructing terra nullius, a land empty of claim that would make space for unencumbered settlement. The presumption of emptiness itself becomes the site of action against the refusal to give over land and history, and as settler colonial technologies and architectures of subjugation and punishment, of surveillance, arrest, interrogation, detention, closure, curfew, passes and permits, material obstruction and material destruction intensify over time, so resistance digs itself deep, at times engendering hunger strikes and refusals to comply. As intensified forms of instrumentalized colonial governmentality and violence set the colonial states of emergency promulgated to protect the state against rebellion, riot, and disorder, codify and structure technologies and architectures of oppression, subjugation, and punishment, authorizing the violence of expulsion and expropriation, control and containment. As zones of repression and separation are assembled, multiple geographies are rendered carceral, landscapes of punishment, of detention, of closure, of mass imprisonment, of surveillance and monitoring, of siege. And rather than going into the detail of the practices that a colonial state of emergency authorizes to bring order from a perceived threat of disorder, I'm going to talk about what I frame as the geographies of punishment, detention, closure, and surveillance that states of emergency engender, with particular reference, of course, to Kenya, colonial Kenya, and across historic Palestine. And I was going to talk a little bit about the historical genealogy, but given time, I'm just going to skip over that, except to just flag that these practices find their genealogy in the British Imperial Project. In Kenya throughout the colonial period from the early 1890s and under the mandate over Palestine from the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And in this sense, Israel in a sense inherited a blueprint for a carceral geography enabled through a continuing state of emergency over historic Palestine. In that sense, Palestine had already accumulated what Anne Stoller describes as, I quote her, the toxic corrosions and violent and cruel of colonial aftermaths. And I can speak later about all the practices authorized under a state of emergency, but I'm going to go on to talking about the multiple and intersecting geographies of punishment found across these settler colonial geographies. Since it is not within the imagination of settler colonialism to apprehend the suffering and harm, that which cannot be endured, wrought by colonial dispossession and oppression, or the capacity for self-determination of the indigenous population, all acts or utterances of resistance to the fragmentation and reassemblage of geographies are framed as revolt and rebellion against the legitimacy and authority of the governing colonial power and of settlers and of settlement. Such acts are consequently framed as disloyalty, illegality, criminality, sedition. Forms of resistance in turn map the contours of interconnected and constantly changing carceral geographies as lines, nodes, and zones of punishment constantly in flux, contain, construct, restrict, enclose, and incarcerate. At any moment a curfew, at any moment closure, at any moment mass arrest, at any moment literature, including newspapers, prescribed and speech rendered illegal. Arbitrary, unpredictable, temporary, engendering the materiality and spatiality of what Stephen Morton describes as, and I quote, law-preserving violence of the colonial order, of the colonial state. This law-preserving violence, be it the violence of expulsion, of incarceration, of land expropriation, is targeted. It's not arbitrary, but specifically at the colonized and occupied, at bodies, collectivities, and geographies deemed to threaten the authority and order of the state. Framed by settler colonialism, and now I quote Denise Ferreira da Silva, as persons, as ethical, juridical entities, not comprehended by universality, the chosen moral descriptor of post-Enlightenment political configurations. The colonial archives on the British colonial emergency over Kenya record the designation of Kenyans as lawbreakers, political agitators, disloyal Kikuyus, terrorists at large, bad persons, notorious terrorists, evil thugs, agitators, villainous leaders. They were framed as bestial. Israeli discourse locates Palestinians as infiltrators, subversives, terrorists, and the enemy. The Bedouin of the South, citizens of the state, are said to be invaders on state land. The official refusal to recognize their villages or their existence, in fact framing them with illegality and criminality. During the 2008-09 military assault on Gaza, all Gazans were designated as combatants. It follows then that the harm and injury resulting from the violence of the colonial state do not therefore, and again I quote Da Silva, unleash an ethical crisis because these persons' bodies and the territories they inhabit always already signify violence. In this racialized geography, I just say a few words about the erasure of indigenous landscape and presence. From the early days of colonial settlement, the Palestinian geography has been systematically erased, destroyed. The destroyed villages of 48 disappearing under the forest, acres of agricultural land flattened to allow sight lines across landscapes, the land sequestered for settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, fenced and militarily protected with bifurcated road systems linking the occupied territory to the state. I can later, if there's time, talk a little bit about the way in which demolition or practices of the state demolition of houses and land creates the terra nullius and is used as a punitive form. But I'll go on now to, very timely, geographies of detention and of mass imprisonment. In the years of British emergency over Kenya, thousands were arrested, screened, detained, or executed. There are some estimates that up to over 1,000 Mau Mau suspects faced capital punishment. The period of the emergency of the 1950s was not the first resistance to British colonial settlement of Kenya. But in 1954, as part of the British colonial state of emergency over Kenya, to quell the resistance of the Land and Freedom Army, also known as Mau Mau, the colonial power through what they named Operation Anvil, arrested, emptied out, and sent for screening all Kikuyu, Meru, and Embu men living in the East Nairobi neighborhood of East Lee. 20,000 suspected Mau Mau sympathy, 20,000 suspected of Mau Mau sympathy and membership were taken for screening to Langata on the outskirts of Nairobi. Their screening determined them to be either white for release, grey of indeterminate status, or black for detention. They were then sent to the detention camps on the coast. Conditions were grim. And I'm only bringing forward the story of Operation Anvil, which is currently part of my research, to illuminate the causality of the whole of the Kenyan geography during the emergency, with zones of arbitrary arrest and interrogation, networks of militarized transport nodes and lines from screening centers to detention camps, and so on. Zones of restrictions, forbidden food production, and the construction of barriers, ditches, and walls, particularly around Kenya. There is likewise not a family or village in historic Palestine that has not been at least, that has not had at least one member arrested, interrogated, or detained, often in mass arrests. Writing in 2014 on what he describes as the vast carceral edifice of control of the occupied Palestinian territories, Rashid Khalidi noted that an estimated 40% of the rural population, that's around 800,000 people, suffered some form of detention, and that up to some 100,000 Palestinians had been subjected to the practice of administrative detention, that is indefinite detention without charge, in the 50 years since the occupation of 1967. Currently, there are some 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners, over 300 children held as prisoners. Some as young as 12 have been administratively detained, others as young as 4 arrested for interrogation, often on suspicion of throwing stones. Nadira Shalhab Kevorkian, a Palestinian researcher, notes that the state security discourse and law enforcement regimes construct each Palestinian child as a potential terrorist, removing them from any ethical political consideration. She continues that the discourse of securitization acts as the pretext with which the Palestinian child may be violated and relegated, along with her community, to zones of uncountedness, unwantedness, ultimately to zones of death. Such zones are a seamless part of the infrastructure of control and containment that is most visible in the materiality of the wall, the checkpoints, the barriers, the surveillance cameras, the centers of interrogation, and the prisons. Okay, I'm going to move on because I'm not running out of time. My third focus is on this geography of closure and enclosure that concerns the forced concentration of occupied populations in the form of the concentrated villages in Kenya and the refugee camps in Palestine, the construction of ditches and physical barriers, the geographic separation marked by military zones, and the imposition of curfews. I can talk about those a bit more later. It's a carceral space of separation defined by designated settlement land, by military zones and firing ranges, and by zones of state ownership. The maps of colonial Kenya, and I think some of them are coming through, delineate the land according to the names of farmers, including African lines, African quarters, squatter camps, guard posts, prisons, and detention camps. In other words, the land is mapped by settler colonial ownership, by the contour of restrictions, and by racialized zones. Likewise, the map of the Jordan Valley inscribes the military zones and settlements that now cover some 40% of the valley. The carceral practice of militarizing the geography as a precursor to settlement is part of the larger expropriation of Palestinian land. I'm going to finish now with, I'll skip some more, finish now with the geography of surveillance and monitoring. that makes up an essential and central part of the castle geography of settler colonialism and the state of emergency. Every Palestinian within the state under occupation across Gaza is subject to monitoring and surveillance, a panopticon both vertical and horizontal. Vertical in surveillance cameras, in cities, in the drones that hover over Gaza. Horizontal at the checkpoints and by the watching eyes of settlers from the hills across the valleys of the occupied West Bank. At every feature of the land, the geography of rivers, wadis, caves, ridges and villages, the spine of the mountain range, the edges of plantations and fields, the carved terraces of olives, the forests, holds within it the resistance to exploitation and the oppression of settler colonial practices. So too every feature is designated a site of disorder, rebellion and riot. Every feature becomes a site for colonial state of emergency monitoring, punishment and closure. I'm just going to finish by talking a little bit about Gaza. So in the vocabulary of settlement and occupation, in the materiality of architectures of oppression and technologies of punishment, we can apprehend castle geography as spatial and material, textual and diagrammatic. It is perhaps in the siege of Gaza, walled, monitored, attacked by drones from the air, its population register controlled by Israel, the sea borders patrolled by the military navy, experienced from the inside as a boarded open-air prison under threat from starvation, disease and infrastructure collapse, that we most clearly and cogently apprehend the overlapping and intersectional castle geographies of punishment, detention, enclosure and surveillance. And I just want to finish with this point, and that's to really to do with the elasticity and reach of the carceral. The carceral landscapes of Kenya and Palestine stretched across the grove, a globe. The British incarcerated militant Jews from Palestine, first in Eritrea, then in the Gilgil detention camp in Kenya during the 1940s, at the same time transporting personnel and practices of control and containment across the imperial administration, from Malaya to Kenya, from India to Palestine, a legacy that continues to ripple through time and geographic space. And I'll finish on this point. Palestinians from the expulsions of 1948 inhabit refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, and those in Syria continuously subject to precarity, injury and harm.
Thank you.